Thank you very much for participating in this business ethics series, The Ethical Challenge. I want to thank Zeithman's for once again partnering with us on this series. In particular, I want to thank Steve Roth and Reem for making this possible. I also want to thank the Bayit and Shai Shamayim for partnering with us and promoting the series. Last week we had Rabbi Ann Standig. God willing, the third part of the series will be next week, same time, and that will be Rabbi Yehuda Mann talking about changing the terms of employment. And that should be an interesting topic. If people could keep their screens on, please do. You know, I don't mind that you're eating. It's lunchtime. That's what this is supposed to be. If we were doing this the way we did before COVID, we would all be eating together at Zeithman's. So it doesn't bother me to see people eating. It's much easier to give a class talking to people I can see, as opposed to boxes. So that's my pitch. In the event that you want credit, please make sure that you sign in the chat. That enables me to know you're here. You do not need to put your email address unless you're not getting our emails. If you're not getting the emails for the series, I may not have your email address, in which case signing in with your name doesn't help me to send you a credit letter. Okay, so our topic for today is COVID, Hockey Canada, and the toxic workplace. I gave a class in our series at Zeithman's probably about 10 years ago, talking about lack of ethical conduct by clients or by one's employer or by customers. And some of this builds on the ideas that we said back then. I think there are a couple of people here who were at that session 10 years ago. I was spurred to do this because of all the news in the last several months about Hockey Canada and their, first of all, the sexual assault issues and cover-ups and so on, and then the fund management issues that came up. I actually brought you on the sheet in source number two. Source number one is just a link for the rules of professional conduct, which I hope you have anyway, but if not, there's a link for it from CPA Ontario. But just the grotesque history of Hockey Canada over the last several years, I'm not going to read out everything that you see there. This is just a timeline I built from the two websites that I listed in source number two, which did a good job of collecting things. But you're talking about a woman being sexually assaulted by eight men after a Hockey Canada event, those men apparently being players. And there's an investigation which is closed, saying the players can't be identified and the woman didn't identify them. And then she sues Hockey Canada in April of 2022. And at that point, I'm just going to put the link in the chat again for the source sheet for those who have just joined. At that point, there is some kind of a settling of a lawsuit in May of 2022, and then a cascade of problems afterwards in terms of whether it was ever investigated in the first place, was it investigated properly in the first place, issues with a fund created for legal fees for sexual assault cases. You can read it for yourself. It's extremely ugly and something that is really just horrifying in its own right. And it raises questions that I want to address. Specifically, Judaism is very strong in condemning any form of violence and abuse, financial, physical, verbal. The laws of Onoas Devarim, Onoas Mammon, for those who are familiar with the terms, are very clear. But what I want to talk about is what Judaism expects of the rest of the organization when people commit abuse. If someone knows that this has happened, what is our expectation of them? What are they supposed to do? And there's a lot to discuss. I have more material than we're going to get to in an hour. I didn't even bother bringing sources for some of the stuff that I know we're not going to get to at the end. But that's what I want to talk about, along with, if you look at the second side of the source sheet, you'll see source number three. how COVID-19 can promote workplace cheating behavior via employee anxiety and self-interest, and how pro-social messages may overcome this effect, which is entirely too long as the name of a paper. Nonetheless, it's an interesting paper from the Journal of Organizational Behavior. It included things I had not seen before. And look what they note here regarding unethical behavior in the workplace in the COVID pandemic. The COVID-19 pandemic has created significant ethical challenges for organizations. For example, a global integrity report from Ernst & Young indicated that 90% of companies report that COVID-19 poses a risk to ethical conduct in the workplace. I didn't look up the Ernst & Young paper. When they say it's global, I don't know if they actually looked at companies world and determined that they had 90%. I don't know where they got that from. I don't know how you do that. But it's not the point. The point is indeed companies reporting a risk to ethical conduct during the pandemic and believed to be caused by the pandemic. Similarly, the popular press has highlighted the ethical toll of the pandemic with headlines such as COVID-19 accelerates unethical behavior. Indeed, a survey conducted during the COVID-19 pandemic indicated that many employees are willing to engage in unethical behavior, including falsifying customer records or providing false information to management. This raises important questions related to why unethical behavior is a prevalent issue during the COVID-19 pandemic and how these effects can be mitigated. So I want to get into that as well. So what I have in mind are four vignettes, and we'll go through them as we arrive, at each one. But the first one is going to be about someone with whom you have a business relationship who is acting unethically, and are you obligated to report them? The second question, I'm sorry, are you obligated to rebuke them? Do you have an obligation to try to change their behavior? The second one is, if they don't listen when you try to change their behavior, do you have a duty to report them? And are you allowed to report them in terms of Jewish law? And then third, the question of organizations apologizing for wrongdoing, and the question of whether an organization must apologize from the perspective of Jewish law, and what happens when the apology could actually endanger the organization. And then finally, the question raised by source number three, what caused the rise in unethical behavior in the workplace during the pandemic, and what can be done about it? That's what I want to get to for our hour together. Clear? Okay? All right. So let's launch into the first one. Take a look, please, at vignette number one. Janet is an independent auditor who often uses the services of Abraham's valuation practice to appraise shares and businesses. I'm assuming, just to make things simple, Janet is Jewish, Abraham is Jewish, and all bound by the laws of the Torah, rather than getting into questions of what applies to someone who is not Jewish. Janet eventually realizes that Abraham's billings to his clients, although not to her, are fraudulently inaccurate. Is Janet obligated to tell Abraham he is acting inappropriately? So Janet uses Abraham's service. Somehow, in the course of their interactions and their conversations, she realizes that Abraham is not being fair to other customers. He is, misreporting the hours that he works. He's misreporting what they owe him for the work, whatever it is. And Janet finds out somehow. So the question now is, does Janet have any obligation to tell Abraham what you're doing is wrong? That's my question to you. What would you say? I need someone to unmute in order to answer this.
No, it's a tough call because the time doesn't mean that's the billing, because there's value added sometimes. And just looking from outside in, it's very difficult to tell the basis of billing.
Right. So George points out maybe Janet is wrong. Maybe Janet is not understanding what's going on. So I could stipulate that she knows it's wrong, or I could ask the question, does she have a duty to bring it up to Abraham, what looks fishy to her? Remember, she's somebody with skills in this area. She's an independent auditor. She's not somebody who's a novice.
Don't the guidelines of our profession say to us that, hey, we're supposed to bring it to our are you assuming that we're the engagement partner or the staff?
So what you are,
Janet.
Right? So Janet is actually completely separate from Avraham. It's just that they have a business relationship.
So
they're not in the same organization.
Okay, so would it not be her price to bring it to Avraham?
So that's my question: is does she have to bring it to him? What would CPA Ontario want from you?
I think CPA Ontario would say we need to at least bring it to Avraham's attention. Forgetting about Torah guidelines, but the CPA Ontario would probably say, hey, you have to indicate something, because after that they talk about resignation from auditing engagements.
Right. So resignation wouldn't be relevant here because, again, this isn't being done by your business. Well, take a look at source number 4, where CPA Ontario gives you guidelines that, honestly, I'm not entirely sure how to apply here. A member or firm, this is rule 406.2, a member or firm engaged in a practice of public accounting to which another business or practice is related or engaged in such related business or practice shall be responsible to CPA Ontario for any failure of a non-member who is associated with such related business or practice and who is under the member's or firm's management or supervision, or with whom the member or firm shares proprietary or other interest in such related business or practice to comply with the CPA code. So, Avraham, I'm assuming, is a non-member. Avraham has an evaluation practice, but he's not a member of CPA Ontario. We're not talking about any personal obligation that he has. Janet, though, is a member. She is in some kind of business relationship with Avraham. She's using his services, and she becomes aware that what he is doing is something which would not be allowed by the rules of CPA Ontario. Does that constitute something that Janet would be required to do something about?
The rules that you read out sounds like it's more like when you're working on an engagement together. Like if she had contracted out to Avraham to do work for her and she knew something he was doing was unethical. I don't know if it applies to if you heard about something that's unrelated to you.
Right. So it's really unclear to me, meaning he is working for her in the sense that, you know, he does appraise shares and businesses on her behalf for her engagements. However, what he's doing is going on outside of the framework of the relationship with her. It's a separate act. And it's not at all clear to me that CPA Ontario would believe that, that you would have to report it. I think if this actually came up for an accountant, they would probably need to pursue legal advice. It is not clear to me that CPI Ontario requires this. What about halacha? What about Jewish law? So it's very important to recognize that halacha has a basic understanding. Jewish law has a basic understanding of the goal of the Jew in the world. The goal is not simply to fulfill my checklist. I am doing the things that are on my list of commandments. But also, my job is to sanctify and spread awareness of God's name in the world. So I have a responsibility regarding the behavior of others, not only regarding my own behavior. So the question becomes, how does that translate in a situation in which I have a connection to somebody and I know that they're doing something wrong? Does that actually obligate me to do something about it? So certainly, you know, whatever, if you determine that the regulations of CPA say you have to contact this person, do something about it, then Judaism is going to say, well, you became a member of CPA Ontario, you agreed to follow the rules, so therefore you have to implement those rules. But within Judaism, we have two related mitzvah imperatives about instructing others in right behavior, so to speak. One is known as tochacha, source number 5. The Torah says, Do not hate your brother in your heart. Rebuke your friend and do not bear sin for him. So you're not supposed to say, if I see somebody doing something inappropriate, I'm just going to be angry and upset about it and I'm not going to do anything. Rather, you have a responsibility to actually rebuke the other person. I use the translation of rebuke. Literally, the term hocheach tochiach or tochacha does not have to mean rebuke. When you say rebuke, it sounds like you're standing there, you know, like with a picket outside of his practice, you know, with a, you know, big signs up and so on, or you're yelling at him. Lehochiach, the Hebrew root, is to show, to demonstrate, to educate. That's really where this where the term comes from. To show somebody the right way to act. Rabbi Yaakov Kanievsky, the stipler, wrote in his Kilos Yaakov, even if it's just that the person is not functioning properly according to their level, like they could be doing better, they could be doing something that is more right, you have a responsibility to try to educate that person. So inevitably, when I talk about this mitzvah with people, the response is, you know, that sounds like a really nice idea, but in practice, that doesn't work out well. We can envision Janet, you know, going to talk to Avraham and saying, you know, Avraham, you do great work for me, but I'm really not okay with your billing practices for your other clients. Yeah. How long will it take Avraham to show Janet the door? This isn't something, usually people who are doing something like this know what they're doing, and they know that it's wrong. And they have no intention of changing their ways. That's number one. Number two, it's really hard to do this well. Like, how do you say this to Avraham in a way that's not insulting and that's not just guaranteed to get him upset? If you take a look at source number 6 from the Talmud in Erchin, Rabbi Tarfon said, I'm just going to read out my English translations for the sources in order to save time. Rabbi Tarfon said, I would be stunned. I'm just going to put the link again in the chat because a couple of people joined. He says, I would be stunned if anyone in this generation would accept rebuke. If one would say, take a splinter from between your eyes, he would reply, take a beam from between your eyes. If I say to somebody, there's a small piece of wood between your eyes, his response to me would be, well, there's a large piece of wood between your eyes. This line, by the way, has analogs outside of Judaism as well. The statement of Rabbi Tarfon is, no one's gonna listen if you tell them what they're doing is wrong. And along comes Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and he says the problem isn't with the person who's not accepting rebuke, the problem is with the person who's giving it. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, I would be stunned if anyone in this generation would know how to rebuke. There's a right way and there's a wrong way, and it's really, really hard to do it the right way. The result being, that, yes, I may have a commandment to do it, but I may not know how to do it properly. Yes, Paul.
And I think we say that if you don't know how to do it properly, you're not meant to do it at all.
So that's actually a really, right. That's a really interesting question. The question of, do you do it knowing that you don't know how to do it well? We're going to come back to the question of, do you do it if you think that there's going to be negative fallout for you? But in terms of not knowing how to do it well, I think that it depends on what it is that you're concerned about. In other words, is my concern I don't know how to do it well, or is my concern I don't know how to do it such that this person will receive it?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I mean, we're talking about if you can do it and there's repercussions to you, but it fixes the problem, then maybe you have to do it.
Well, that's
fix the problem.
Right, so that's something we're going to talk about. But what I mean is, it's entirely possible that somebody does it well. In other words, they're polite, they preserve the person's dignity, they make sure they know what's going on, you know, they're not making a mistake, they're not doing it because they just want to get the other guy or show that they're greater than, and it's still not going to work. Such a person, I think, is still obligated to make the attempt. Because you don't really know. And there's a lot of material on this mitzvah, and I should have put a link here, I've taught classes on this mitzvah itself. There's a lot to be said about the extent of the obligation, but all I wanted to do right now is just to show this is one reason why Janet should say something to Avraham from a Jewish perspective. There's a second related mitzvah, which is called in Hebrew or in Aramaic, afrushe mei sura, separating somebody from wrongdoing. Separate from the mitzvah of telling them what you're doing is wrong, there's a more active obligation to try to keep people from doing things that are wrong. If you take a look at source number 7 as an example of this, Rabbi Moshe Sofer connects it to the idea that we identify in Hebrew as arevut, mutual responsibility. He says, one is specifically instructed to keep a Jew from sinning, for all Israel are responsible for each other. Not regarding non-Jews, even for their prohibitions. If there's a non-Jew who's breaking his rules, I don't have an obligation to go out of my way to get him to stop. I'm not allowed to mislead him into doing things that are wrong. But I'm not obligated to actually stop him. That's a family responsibility. There's no joint responsibility. And so one need not separate them from it unless there were an issue of causing the blind to stumble. I'm not allowed to cause them to make a mistake. But my obligation to keep somebody from sinning is specifically regarding Jews, where we have family responsibility to stop them from sinning. I find his framing of it interesting because of a different point, which I want to take a minute to explain. It's worth explaining. You may know that a Jew is allowed to recite Kiddush, right, Friday night on behalf of another Jew. Right? It's 100% fine for me to say Kiddush on behalf of somebody else and they just answer Amen. Not only am I able to do that, but even if I have already performed the mitzvah of Kiddush, I can say it again on behalf of somebody else, even though I don't need it. It's not my mitzvah at this point. Why am I able to do that if I already fulfilled my mitzvah? Because of the principle that Rabbi Sofer invoked, that we are all responsible for each other. So when he does the mitzvah, I am doing the mitzvah. It's my mitzvah. You follow? Because I am responsible for them, when they do it, it's like I am doing it. And what Rabbi Sofer is teaching me is, yeah, but it works the other way also. That means if they sin, I am sinning. And therefore, I have a responsibility to try to prevent them, as part of my family, from doing something that is wrong. Rabbi Avram Shmuel Binyamin Wolf Sofer, Ksav Sofer, says, I think he's the son of the Chasam Sofer, in source number 8, he says, I think it's actually a biblical obligation. It stems from the commandment to rebuke, that you have a duty to keep people from doing things that are wrong. He writes, where they will listen, one must tell. You have to tell them to keep them from accidental error. You have to help people not to sin. So I have two different obligations. You follow? One is the rebuke, and one is keeping people from sinning. Miriam, you were going to say?
When we look at the pasuk itself, at the beginning of the pasuk, Al tisna dachicha bilvavecha, hocher tochia, that isn't the juxtaposition of those two stem basically from a situation where he's done something wrong to you. Because you wouldn't hate your brother in your heart if he's doing something wrong generally or to someone else. And it seems to me to be only really a case of, oh, he's done something wrong to me, I'm angry, but I'm not supposed to keep that in my heart, I need to tell him.
So it's interesting. It's interesting. What you're saying is a logical read of the verse. But the rabbis have actually gone the exact opposite way. And what they've said is, if somebody does something to you, you're not allowed to hate them. The Torah will not allow you to hate them. The case of hating somebody that we're describing here must be where somebody did something that is just a general violation of the Torah, and it's not about you personally. So it's specifically the opposite. They say this can't be a personal vendetta. Don't hate somebody for general wrongdoing. Tell them this is the right way to do it. They take it just the opposite. It's very funny. But I agree with you. Your read is a logical read of the sentence. So we do have certain limitations for these obligations. The obligation to separate somebody from wrongdoing really may not apply if it's somebody who isn't going to listen to you, somebody who's just not going to be convinced. So if you take a look at source number 9, Rabbi Aryeh Leib Ginsburg, the Turei Eben, He says, certainly all Israel must keep sinners from sinning where possible. And so we must separate minors from prohibitions. If you know a kid is going to do something wrong, you should keep him from doing it, since we can keep him from sin. But he's commenting on a particular passage in the Talmud in which it wasn't possible to keep people from sinning. The people were going to do it anyway. And so he says, there your obligation does not apply. That's number one. Indeed, some argue that this obligation of keeping people from sinning, not the rebuke one, but keeping people from sinning, the second one, doesn't apply to intentional sinners. That's number one. However, the mitzvah of tochacha, of rebuke, might apply even if they know it's wrong. That might apply even where they know it's wrong. This is subject to debate. Source number 10 is a rabbinic commentary on a passage in the Talmud which tells a story. It's based on verses in the prophet Yechezkel. I'm not going into the entire passage. But basically what happens is there's a passage in the prophet Yechezkel which seems to indicate that God first decreed that a punishment should be brought upon those who had sinned in a particular place. And then God said, you should begin the punishment from the holy ones, the people who have not sinned. And the Talmud gives you the following story. It says, God wanted to bring punishment, but only on those who had sinned, not on everybody else. And God's attribute of justice complained and said, what's the difference between the two groups? And God's response is, well, these people sinned and these people didn't sin. And justice says to God, yes, however, the other ones should have protested. The ones who didn't sin really should have protested. And God's response is, but even had they protested, it wouldn't have been effective. No one was going to listen. To which justice says, you know that, and I know that. But they're human beings. They don't know that. They're not allowed to give up hope on other people. They have a responsibility to rebuke, and God agrees with the attribute of justice. This is all in the Talmud, and the story is in Shabbat 55a. So Tosfot there comments and says, it depends on how sure you are. The commentary says, this is where one does not know whether they will accept, as the Talmud says. Is it obvious to them that others won't listen? But where they definitely will not accept, leave them. Better for them to sin accidentally than intentionally. Don't start yelling at people who you know aren't going to listen anyway. You follow? That was a little bit long-winded. But Tosfot says you don't, at least if you're dealing with rabbinic law. That's a sub-piece of this that we're not going to get into. Maybe rabbinic is different from biblical. But he says don't do it. If you really know they won't listen, don't do it. Whereas, in source number 11, Rabbi Yosef ibn Chaviv, the Nimuke Yosef, disagrees, and he says, no, you have to try at least once. You have to try at least once. You can't just leave it be. So, what this means is, Janet says, Avram's been doing this professionally for many, many years. He knows it's wrong. He's not gonna listen to me. Are you really serious? Are you really going to tell me that I have a responsibility that I should talk to him about this? There's no way he's going to listen. It ain't going to happen. Like, you really expect me to go that route? The response...
Can I take this thing from a different point of view?
Yes, Jerry.
There's a story of when somebody's in a rowboat. You and somebody's in a rowboat.
Yeah.
And the person says, I want to drill a hole under my seat.
Yes.
What do you do? This is exactly like that, but slightly far-fetched. And that is that the fact that he's Jewish and you're Jewish and he's doing this to the outside world, that is going to affect you because of the way the world works, unfortunately. If any one Jew does something wrong, it's all Jews' guys.
So that's a really good...
It does affect me.
You're making a good point. I'm going to come back to that. That's going to be an issue in vignette number two. So hold off, please, but definitely an important point. Thank you. What we have right now is a statement that the second level of keep people from sinning may not apply. The level of rebuke may apply. There are actually also there's a separate issue of what if Abraham knows that Janet knows and she doesn't protest? Does that support and confirm Abraham in his behavior? I'm not even going into that one. That's a whole separate issue in halacha. But here's a key point, and this goes back to something that I think it was Paul who asked. Let's say we take the view that, yes, you have to say something at least once, even when you know they won't listen. What about if you know that what's going to happen is, as a result, Avram is going to say, I don't want anything to do with you. Forget it. I'm not working with you anymore. And now Janet is going to have to find somebody else, going to have to pay more for it. Does Janet have to harm her own business in order to tell Avram what he's doing is wrong? So this question has come up over the ages, obviously. It's not a new question. And the answer seems to be, you do not need to, in a case of serious financial harm. There are a number of stories in the Talmud which support this, which if we had time to really focus on this vignette, I would take the time to show it to you. But instead, I'm just showing you source number 12, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in 16th century Poland, the Ashkenazi writer in the Shulchan Aruch, and he says, where there is concern for danger, one need not spend for the purpose of rebuke. You don't need to harm yourself in order to rebuke. That's one line. And then second, look at his formulation in source number 13. He says, although one must protest to transgressors, still one need not spend money for this. You don't have to take a financial hit in order to get people to engage in right behavior. And therefore, he says, therefore, the practice is to be lenient regarding protesting to transgressors out of concern, lest they attack our bodies and our possessions. You don't need to suffer that kind of a hit in order to do that. So that's I think, an interesting point. Paul and Miriam, I saw your hands, but I want to get to one other point before I close the vignette, and I can take questions about the vignette as a whole. Because there's another concern. Concern number one is maybe CPA Ontario requires me to speak up. Concern number two is, do I have an obligation to rebuke and to keep people from sinning? But there's another problem. There's a principle we are taught in Pirkei Avot, which says, Al titchaber larasha, don't join yourself with wicked people. Choose your company wisely. If you take a look at source number 14, this is a passage in Tanakh, which is one of the sources for it, from Divrei HaYamim Bet, Chronicles 2, which tells the story of a king. Afterward, Yehoshaphat, king of Judea, joined Ahaziah, king of Israel. This is the period when there are two Jewish kingdoms in Israel. There's a northern kingdom called Israel. There's a southern kingdom called Judea. The king of the southern kingdom, Yehoshaphat, is a good king. And the king of the northern one, Ahaziah, is a terrible king. He committed evil. Well, they joined forces in an endeavor. They partnered to make boats to travel to Tarshish. They made the boats in Etzion Geber. The idea was a commercial venture. Let's go in together on something. They're not partnering to do bad things. They're partnering to make money. But a prophet came along. His name was Eliezer, son of Dodavahu of Maresha, and he prophesied upon Yehoshaphat, saying, when you joined with Ahaziah, God destroyed your deeds. The ships were smashed. Meaning, you weren't supposed to join with a wicked person. Why not join with a wicked person? In the interest of time, I'm just going to answer this one. Number one, you encourage them in what they're doing. They again think, this person partners with me, what I'm doing is fine. But also, you become influenced. You become like them. Even without engaging in their activities, the closer your relationship is, the more likely that you will be influenced. Now here, Janet is just hiring Avram to do a job. I don't know that she'll really be influenced by what Avram is doing. It's not so likely. But this is also a concern that one should be thinking about. So to sum up what we said on this vignette, and then I'll take the questions and comments, what we're saying is CPA Ontario's guidance is unclear because really the relationship between Janet and Avraham is on one issue and Avraham's wrongdoing is in a separate issue and they're not in the same organization. You could legitimately make the claim that Janet has no obligation from the perspective of CPA Ontario. If she does, then Jewish law would say Janet has to say something because she accepted the rules of CPA Ontario. Separately, there may be a duty of rebuke or keeping Avram from sinning, but may be mitigated, number one, if he knows what he's doing and he isn't planning on changing. And number two, in the event that the you make the argument that Avraham, the second piece of it is that it could cause Janet financial harm if she has to go find somebody new because Avram doesn't want to work with her anymore. And third, there's an imperative for her to step away because you're not supposed to join yourself with people who are doing bad things. And that's another piece of the puzzle. Okay, Miriam and then Paul.
So when we refer to Source 12 and the issue of sakana, like a financial problem, could it also be social sakana? Like if you do this, you will be blacklisted. The person doesn't want to have anything to do with you socially. And let's say we're talking about someone rebuking someone for a religious practice. We're not in the vignette that we're in about a financial practice.
Right. So this is a very interesting question. I don't know. The reason I say I don't know is because generally speaking, if it's just social harm without any other repercussions, I don't think we would accept it as grounds for not speaking up. Our obligation to God comes before our social well-being. However, social well-being has ties to so many other meaningful things, from mental health to financial issues. You know, there are so many other things that in one's life that are tied to it. Just being disapproved of by others, I don't think is sufficient, but the ramifications might be. So this is a delicate question.
But we don't see, for instance, let's say even walking through an Orthodox shul, let's say where everybody is supposed to be committed to this, that people are going around saying, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. Do we see that? Would that be a comfortable thing? Is that appropriate?
So I think what you're saying reflects the fact that there's a sense of, going back to our source about Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria, of I don't know how to do this well, therefore I'm not going to do it at all. Or they're not going to listen to me because, yes, they're committed to everything, but the things that they're doing wrong, they know they're doing wrong, and they're not so committed on that. Or they have their reason for doing it that way. We can all think of things that we know people get wrong, that they don't take it well when somebody says, you know you're doing that wrong. I'm not saying that it's right that people don't say, but I'm saying that I understand why people don't say. And there's a combination, I think, of the social fear that you mention and religiously feeling like I would do it wrong and I would create a problem if I spoke up. I'm going to ask you to hold back now from continuing on that. I don't know if you want to say something further, but I want to take Paul's comment and then go further because we only have 22 minutes to go and we got three more vignettes.
I'll be super quick with that. A very brief observation about how similar the words you gave about her need to do the event you might harm yourself has to do with the medical ethics presentation on Monday night. It just almost aligned.
Yes.
I just wanted to point that out.
No, you are correct. This is a medical ethics principle in a big way as well. So I'm gonna go to vignette number two. Vignette number two, if you flip back to the first side, not the first side, to the second side. Janet speaks with Avraham. Janet says, I'm gonna bite the bullet. And she tells Avraham what he's doing is wrong. He brushes it off and he warns Janet to keep quiet about what she has discovered. Will Jewish law allow Janet to take her concerns to regulatory authorities? This is not an issue now of, is she obligated to rebuke him or not? It's a question of, is she allowed to turn him over? And the concern here is what we call mesira. The question of, is a Jew allowed to report another Jew to non-Jewish authorities? If you take a look at source number 16, right now we're going to pretend that Avram is a member of the of CPA Ontario, because otherwise the vignette won't make any sense. So take a look at source number 16. This is from the Rules of Professional Conduct, the Code of Professional Conduct, Rule 211.1. A member or firm shall promptly report to CPA Ontario any information concerning an apparent breach of the CPA code or any information raising doubt as to the competence, integrity, or capacity to practice of another member or firm, unless such disclosure would result in the breach of a statutory not to disclose, things that aren't relevant for our case. From here, it seems like Janet is required to report it. She knows that another member, remember, Avram is now a member, she knows another member is engaged in impropriety. an apparent breach of the CPA code, Janet would seem to be obligated to report, right? Does that fit your read of Rule 211? Yes? I see yeses from the people whose screens are on. Those screens are off. I can't tell whether you're nodding your head yes or disagreeing. What am I supposed to do? I'm going to assume you say yes also. So the...
This ties into that suggestion that I just made.
Yes, and here I'm coming back to it. This is what I meant when I said we're coming back to it. That's what I'm talking about. Is a Jew able to report somebody who is engaged in wrongdoing? So in source number 17, I gave you a link for a session I gave for lawyers 6 years ago on reporting child abuse and the way that Judaism views that, where this question looms very large. And the answer is absolutely 100% reported. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Just report it. That is the rule. And you can listen to the recording there to hear me say that for an hour. But I gave you the Cole's notes. But how do we view this issue of Mesira? So I brought you the Rambam, Maimonides, in source number 18, who says, one may not hand a Jew to the control of the nations, whether physically or financially, even where he is wicked and a sinner, and even where he causes him trouble and pain. Anyone who gives a Jew to the nations, whether physically or financially, has no share in the next world. So he seems to be very black and white. Like, no, you may not turn him over. I should note that there's an exception, which I stopped the line before the exception because it wasn't relevant to our case, but it's relevant now because Jerry mentioned it. In the event that somebody is acting in a way that's going to harm the community, then this rule is suspended. So if the classic case is you have a Jew who's engaged in counterfeiting, and when he gets caught, then everybody's going to say, look at the Jews, and it's going to redound against the Jewish community. So then they say, that's a different story, and you turn the person in. But let's say we're not dealing with a case where there's a clear sense of harm to the community. So do we say that the Rambam's rule pertains? And the answer is, not necessarily. We have to understand why the Rambam wrote what he wrote in source number 18. And there are two passages in the Talmud that give us explanations, two different explanations. Number one, source number 19, Bava Kama, Kuf Tez Zayin. They give you a story. There was somebody who showed bandits the bale of wheat of the exilarch. The exilarch is the political leader of the Jews in Babylon. He's a wealthy man. He's got a lot of wheat. Somebody wanted to curry favor with bandits. And the way he did it was to show them, look, there's this property of the exilarch. You can go take it. And the bandits took the wheat. So the exilarch comes to Rav Nachman, leading rabbinical judge of his day. And Rav Nachman said, you have to pay the exilarch for the harm that you caused. You caused property damage. You turn over somebody's finances, you turn over somebody's property, you are liable for the harm you caused, even though the harm was indirect, because really all you did was point to it and then they took it. Nonetheless, you are liable. That's number one, is you're liable if you cause somebody financial harm. Number two, there's a fear that by turning the Jew over, you could endanger their life. Because historically, Jews turned over to the government on charges could end up dead for the most minor of charges. Source number 20. Someone tried to show another person's straw to bandits. Same type of a case, except it's not the exilarch. He came to Rav, this person who was going to do that, came to Rav and told him, I don't know what I want to do. Rav, the sage, says to him, don't show it, don't show it, don't do it. And he replied, I'm going to do it. You bet I'm going to do it. Rav Kahana is sitting in front of Rav, he's a student of Rav, and he breaks the man's neck to stop him from doing it. Rav quotes a verse from Yeshayahu, from Isaiah. The verse goes, your sons have fainted, they lie at the head of every street like an antelope in a trap. This is a statement about when the Jews are suffering, when the Jews are under the hands of their persecutors. They're like an antelope in a trap. What does that mean? What's the image? Just as this antelope, once it falls in the trap, no one has mercy on it. So the property of Israel, once it falls into the hands of idolaters, they don't have mercy upon it or upon him. Meaning, you're starting financially. You're just turning over somebody's straw to bandits. But the result is going to be physical harm. His life is going to be in danger. And so what you have are two reasons why Maimonides says what he does in source number 18. Number one, you're turning over somebody's property where maybe Jewish law would not recognize he's liable. And number two, when you turn over his property, the result can be harm to his life. So the question becomes, does that apply in Janet's case, where Abraham is cheating customers? And the answer, I already see the head shakes, no. The answer, of course, is not. Number one, because it's not Abraham's property. Abraham is stealing from people. I brought you an example of this in source number 21, where Rabbi Isserles in 16th century Poland talks about a case in which a Jew owes a debt, and he is trying to get out of paying the debt. He knows he owes the debt. There's no question about the legitimacy of the debt, but he's trying to avoid paying. And somebody else reveals it to the authorities. So that's not called Mesira, he says, because you only cost the person what he was obligated to pay anyway. So therefore, he absolutely owes the money, and you're not costing him anything. And I think the person who asked me in the chat about Dina de Malchusa, law of the land, is reflected here in what we're saying. The guy owes the money. I mean, there's more to be said about it, but it certainly plays into it. If the guy really owes it, he owes it. Or I see what you're asking. You're asking about earlier when I said that maybe if the Torah wouldn't hold the person liable, then you're, right. That's, now I understand the question. But the answer is not necessarily, because it depends on whether there is a law of the land to it or whether it's just theft. Meaning, if you go back to the Talmud's case of the Roman tax collectors who just took whatever they wanted, that is not authorized by Dina de Malchusa, by law of the land. It has to be that there's an actual law that we're dealing with, not just persecution. But number one, this isn't Abram's property. And number two, he's not in danger. His life is not in danger. We're talking about Canada in 2022. You turn him over to the courts for stealing, for cheating customers, he's going to have to pay a fine. He's going to have, he may lose his license, or he may be censured or something like that. But it's not as though his life is at risk. And Rabbi Yechiel Michel Epstein in source number 22 makes this point. I'm going to read this out because it's really funny. Rabbi Yechiel Michel Epstein is rabbi in Nowarduk in Poland, end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And he writes about the laws of Mesira, of not handing over a Jew. He says, it is known to all who read history that in earlier times in distant lands, people lacked financial and personal security from bandits, even though they carried a title of authority. As is known even today from some African lands, the theft that the rulers practiced. It was terrible, those lawless societies. The European kings should be mentioned for the good, especially our master, the Tsar of Russia and his fathers, the Caesars and kings of Britain, who spread the wings of their reign in distant lands in order for each person to have personal and financial security, such that wealthy people need not hide themselves to avoid despoiling of their assets and being killed. He says, the Tsar is wonderful. There's no issue of Mesira in the lands under the Tsar. The Tsar would never do anything dishonest. He would never do anything hurtful. Of course these laws don't apply here. So, you know, you read it and you recognize somebody who's trying to avoid the censors. And that's, you know, it's an apologetic that's going on here. Nonetheless, his words get quoted in modern authorities regarding areas where the government really does have good laws and they carry them out justly. So Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, Rabbi Yeshaya Blau, both in Israel, Rabbi Asher Weiss, they all quote this and say this issue of Mesira is not relevant. So it is clear that if Abraham is not going to listen, if Janet talks to Abraham and Abraham is not interested in changing, then Janet is going to follow the rules of CPA Ontario and is going to turn him over. Certainly, to go back to where we started with Hockey Canada, it would be absolutely incumbent on anybody in the organization who knew what had happened to step forward and report it. That would be a very strict and clear halachic obligation. I want to move to vignette number three. I see your hand, but it's 120, and I really want to make sure to get to number three as well. Vignette number three is the public apology. So if you go back to the vignettes again, I'm changing the case now. Janet and Abraham have retired. We're now involved with Susan and Richard. So Susan, the CEO of a nonprofit, learns that Richard, the director of fundraising, has been directing contributions into his own profit, into his own pocket, right? He's the director of fundraising. He's directing the fundraising right into his pocket. The organization has never experienced anything like this. Richard had no record of such activity in the past. But it does appear that the leadership missed clear warning signs as Richard provided incomplete financial information at meetings over the past year. Susan wants to issue a full, transparent apology, but she is concerned about potential legal fallout from admitting guilt. What advice can counsel give regarding apologies from secular and Jewish perspectives? Do you apologize or do you not apologize? So I gave a class, a legal ethics class, it was in June, on crisis management. And I gave you a link in source number 23. And there I discussed this issue at length, but I want to just deal with this aspect of it. To be clear, in an ideal world, apologies are a must, both secularly and religiously. Secularly, I gave you a reference here in number 24 to a paper, Legal Consequences of Apologizing, from the Journal of Dispute Resolution, in which they make the point, I'm not going to read it aloud just because of time, but they basically say that apologies help those who have been injured. It helps them to heal when they see that the attacker feels bad or the attacker says, I never intended it in the first place. It's important for the aggressor to regain self-respect by apologizing. Look, I am a good person. There are also practical benefits to apologizing because especially if you're talking about a nonprofit, a Hockey Canada, your product is trust. If you are raising money from the public, in order to do things, you need their trust. You need to apologize in order to get it back. Apologies can even help you avoid being sued, which is important, and they tend to bias a jury to see the apology as a mitigating factor. From a secular perspective, there are lots of reasons to apologize. From a Jewish law perspective, tshuva requires vidui. If you want to repent, you have to acknowledge what you have done wrong. I gave you from Maimonides, from the Rambam, in his Laws of Repentance in source number 25, where he says it straight out, that when you're going to do tshuva, when you're going to repent, that requires a verbal admission of wrongdoing. When a person sins against somebody else, then we say that you have to apologize to the other. If you take a look at source number 26 as an example of that, social transgressions like wooting another person, cursing him, stealing from him, and the like are never forgiven, meaning forgiven by God, until he gives the other what he owes and he appeases him. You have this responsibility if you harm somebody else in any way, whether it's wounding, whether it's financial. The commentators discuss Maimonides' comments in 26 and 27 and note that it seems to apply even in a case of just financial harm. So there's a clear imperative to apologize from the perspective of Jewish law, from the perspective of secular society. But there's a problem, because an apology can be construed as an admission of guilt. Counsel says, wait a minute, what are you doing? You're going to apologize? Oh, are you going to be in trouble? In Jewish law, an apology might get you in trouble in a civil case, not in a criminal case, because Jewish law in a criminal case says you are your own relative, and therefore your words cannot lead to your conviction. Ein adam meisim atzmo rasha, in source number 28. The Talmud says, your words cannot be used against you. But in a civil case, source number 29, admission by a litigant is like 100 witnesses. You admit that you did it wrong, you are vulnerable to a civil suit. So what happens? So, interestingly, in Jewish law, there is no mitigation. In other words, you have to weigh your soul against your pocketbook. That's what you have to do. You just have to say, is it really worth it to me not to be forgiven? And I show you here source number, no, it's not on the sheet. I thought that I brought it. Hang on. No, I didn't bring it. It's a passage in the Talmud, Sanhedrin Dav Zayin. I should have brought it here. I apologize. I didn't include it. But it says that a person who is found guilty in court should leave the courts singing. He should be thrilled. He should be happy. Because that means that you're now innocent of wrongdoing. Because you gave away, you gave back the stolen goods. Have to remember to put that on the source sheet. That should have been there. To the person who asked me in the chat, but you have Yom Kippur. You do have Yom Kippur. However, Yom Kippur would not absolve you of owing somebody money. If somebody, if you did something wrong to somebody financially, and you apologize to them before Yom Kippur, it's well and good that you apologize. That's important, but you still have to pay them back. That's if you look at Maimonides, back in source number 26. He says you're never forgiven until you give the person what you owe and you appease him. So that's still going to be required. And because you apologized and admitted wrongdoing, that's going to be used against you in court. But what about the secular? So I'll tell you about something which not everybody knows about, but it's in Ontario law. It's something called the Apology Act. And the Apology Act, when I first learned about it, I thought, whoa, that's so Canadian. But actually, someone who was involved in drafting it told me it existed in jurisdictions in the U.S. first. Haha. But take a look at source number 30. Despite any other act or law, evidence of an apology made by or on behalf of a person in connection with any matter is not admissible in any civil proceeding, administrative proceeding, or arbitration as evidence of the fault or liability of any person in connection with that matter. Your apology cannot be used against you. Now, there are certain cases where it can be used against you. So an example of that will be if you're giving testimony in a civil proceeding, it can be used against you. So don't apologize on the witness stand. That's number one. Number two, in a criminal proceeding, it can be used against you. So if Richard is facing criminal charges for redirecting the funds, or in the Hockey Canada case, if somebody is being investigated for criminal prosecution, yes, your apology can be used against you. So you do have to know that. Nonetheless, it can help in many cases to encourage people to apologize, which really is important both religiously and secularly. You follow? That's what I'm saying, albeit a little quickly. Last point, vignette number four. I'm just going I'm going to skip the vignette because it's 128. I just wanted to make the very interesting point. It was very interesting to me. The paper that I referred to in the beginning from Hillebrand and Barclay, where they study COVID-19 workplace misbehavior. So basically, they argue the following. They argue that that people who are in circumstances that increase anxiety tend to focus more on their own well-being. That's really the key. People who are in situations where they are anxious tend to focus on how I am doing and what my needs are, and therefore they are more likely to engage in misconduct. There's a key paper that everybody quotes in this from source number 32 from the Journal of Applied Psychology, which I'm just going to read aloud my little excerpt there. We suggest that people experiencing anxiety are likely to behave selfishly and possibly even engage in self-interested unethical acts in an effort to restore the threatened self. Specifically, we expect individuals experiencing anxiety to focus inward and acquire resources as a means of mitigating feelings of anxiety. People who are anxious, people who are afraid, like people were certainly at the start of the pandemic, are more likely to act in an unethical way because they are looking to safeguard their lives and their own families and their own interests. Tanakh provides a graphic example of this with the story of Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, and his Ruach Ra'ah. He loses the throne because of his failure to follow God's instructions as conveyed by the prophet Shmuel. As a result, he loses his attachment to God. And in source number 33, we are told that a harmful spirit frightened him, which the commentators explain as a form of anxiety. And he descends into horribly destructive and self-destructive behavior, as I listed for you in source number 34, in his attempts to get at his eventual successor, King David. He massacres a population. He brings thousands of soldiers to attack King David. So the question is, what do you do about this? how do you prevent that? And it's 1:30, so maybe we'll do a part two in the spring, and we'll continue this this conversation. Thank you very much. I'll stay on for a few minutes because I really rushed the last two vignettes. So I'll stay on for a little bit, but those who have to go, understood. Just make sure that you sign in, please, once again, in order to get credit. Thank you very, very much. Mark, you were going to say? You're muted.
I don't know, relevant to what you're talking about, you mentioned very much in passing NDAs and non-disclosure agreements.
Yes.
And they have been really, really blamed for huge issues. That's a level of coercion, that it's unequal levels of power, it causes psychological damage, they've been muzzled, and harms preventing publicity and creating precedents. I'm wondering if you can say about that in halakha.
So I think it's true. I mean, I think NDAs are a problem. It would be wonderful if we just had a basic NDA, non-disclosure agreement, called the Torah, which says you're not allowed to go around saying bad things about other people, right? Lashon Hara is not allowed. Motzi Shem Ra is not allowed. So therefore, make sure that you don't say things that you're not supposed to say, and everybody's good and they go their separate ways. I think that it is legitimate for a party to say, I want to go even further and I want to make sure, let's say you have a couple that's getting divorced and the member of the couple says, you know, I'm worried about what you're going to say to people and it's going to prevent me from remarrying. So I want to make sure that you don't say anything. So it's fine to request non-disclosure, and come to an agreement, but not if it becomes, I won't give you a get unless you enter into it. It can't be the product of, you know, that kind of pressure. That's where I would draw the line.
But I mean, for example, if there's been abuse and you're signing an agreement, you're getting a payout, and you can't actually speak about it ever again.
You're talking about in the marriage case I gave?
No. I'm talking like an employer-employee.
So the employer has been abusive, and the employee, in order to get the payout, is not going to tell anybody about it. That's an interesting question. Not so much to me in terms of the employee forgiving his right to speak about it, but in the sense that you have a duty to warn people in the event that they are getting themselves into a situation where they're going to be harmed. So someone's going to come to you and ask, you know, I know you used to work for so-and-so, what's it like? And now you can't say anything. I mean, I guess you could say something like, you might want to look into it and not be in violation of your NDA. I don't know how that works. But I think it's a really interesting question, and I don't have an answer, you know, on one foot. I think it's a legitimate question. Okay, Terry.
Further to that, by just not, if somebody asks you, and you're not permitted to say anything about the case, about your circumstances, by just saying, I cannot say anything, that has to ring alarm bells too.
Yeah, it does. I think it should ring alarm bells. The company is going to respond. We always do NDAs. You know, it's standard procedure. There's nothing here, and so on. So says Elon Musk. You know, I mean, I don't know. I really want to think about this. I have to include this in part two because I want to think about it properly before saying anything. But the question of both sides. Is it ethical to demand an NDA and pay for it? And number two, if you have an NDA, is it ethical for you to simply say, go investigate, you know, there's something, you know, you might want to look into it further. Is that an okay thing to say? I think both sides of this are very interesting questions. So I think this is something I want to revisit once I've had a chance to really explore it. Okay, thank you very much, everybody. And tune in next week.